Hey y'all, and welcome to the debut episode of the Outlaw History Podcast. My name is Trey, and I am your host, your interviewer, your staff historian, and your master of ceremonies. I've been wanting to do this podcast for a long time. I'm a huge fan of podcasts where people just sit down and have a conversation with interesting people within and without their profession. My profession is a historian. I am a fourth-year PhD student at Texas A&M University. I am a Civil War historian, and I am an advocate for building a better South. To learn more about that, please visit my Twitter page, at Outlaw Historian, and if you're listening to this anytime in the near future, the pinned tweet will be a YouTube link to my recent TEDx talk about Southern Civil War memory. You guys will get to know me better soon enough, but this podcast isn't really about me or my work, it's about the guest. My goal is to bring you a new interview every single week with a historian or another academic or someone who has something worth talking about. So like I said, I've wanted to do this for a long time, and last weekend an old friend of mine was in town, and I went and bought a microphone and we sat down and recorded a podcast. My guest this week is Nicholas Mosvik. He is a fantastic legal historian of the American Civil War. We were in part trained together. We get into that a wee bit in the show. And I knew that he would be a perfect guest to kick off the podcast because he is so smart and so enthusiastic about his research. And that is exactly the kind of person that I want to talk to on this podcast. I want to take just a second to apologize for the quality of the audio. I am brand new to podcasting, but I promise I will get better soon. What I recorded has been rendered listenable by my friend Chris Rowley, who will be serving as our producer until I have time to figure out what the hell I'm doing. As always, I claim sole credit for all flaws and mistakes in the show. All right, we're here. First time ever doing an interview. First time ever recording a podcast. So any number of things could go wrong, and most of them probably will. I'm sitting here tonight with a good friend of mine. He holds a bachelor's degree in history and political science from the University of Minnesota Twin Cities, a JD and an MA in legal history from the University of Virginia, and he is a PhD candidate at the University of Mississippi. Nicholas Mosvik. Nick, how are you?
I'm well. How are you, Trey?
Good, good. Thank you so much for being my guinea pig on this little experiment here. We were talking earlier, and I said we need to save some of this for the podcast because we had just such great content. But talk about how you first developed an interest in history.
I think the first thing I really remember vividly was in the seventh grade, my grandfather, who was a communications professor for nearly 50 years, he had a library forever, a massive library. And I found this collection of books written in the 19th century after the Civil War by participants in the Civil War. It's called The Battles and Leaders of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. Many historians and many non-historians know this series. And he had all four volumes, and he let me take those, and he let me take his Bruce Canton books. And I got through all of this, and before I knew it, I was questioning my teacher and arguing over what the first Union victory in the Civil War was. Now, Trey will tell you that I had it wrong anyways, but so did my teacher at the time. And I wasn't about ready to give up on that perfect score on the test. So I think then I knew I was hooked. And from that point, I was collecting Civil War books right and left. And so it really started off with primarily military history for the longest time.
That's what grabs most people to start with. I remember when I've told this before, I told it in my TEDx, and it was even in my statement of purpose when I applied to graduate programs, that when I was in fourth grade, I just randomly picked up a book about Abraham Lincoln and was immediately fascinated. This is the first I'm ever hearing about the Civil War, and as so many of us are, I was fascinated by the military and political aspects. Not to get too off topic, and I could be completely wrong here, but just based on speaking to people who aren't professional historians about their interest in history, generally people, they do find the political and military aspect more interesting, but there will be some people who don't like that, but they really are interested in sort of social history, material history, looking at how people lived. And that's fine, and they're both great, and I know you and I agree, we need all of that together.
Yeah, and I think part of that has to do with, you know, what we would say are people's priors. In other words, the values that they already hold in their lives, or the ideologies that they have, the philosophy that they carry. And, you know, so for a lot of people, political events in their lives now are very important to them. They want to follow them. They believe that they're important. So when they look to history, they want to know about that. And with the military, I think it's that it's vivid. It feels like something that is at once picturesque and horrifying and surreal. And so when you read about it, it almost overwhelms the senses in a way that few other things in history do. And so I think that's one reason that, especially for non-historians, military history is so fascinating. And I think the other reason is because something somewhat obvious we don't say enough is, which is when we're looking at American history and world history, wars are major events, and they create incalculable social and political change by their very nature. And so it's impossible in some respects to avoid wars. And of course, the Civil War, surely we'll talk about, is an example of this. By its very conduct, it ends up changing the country fundamentally going forward.
War,
I think that's important.
It seems like war is almost the chaos that creates the continuity in history.
Well, and it's, you know, it's why for the longest time human beings treated it is sort of part of what civilized nations did. And why did they think that? Experience taught them that. And that doesn't mean we have to think war is, in fact, a good thing. It just means that when we're thinking about history, wars are very significant inflection points throughout history. And the United States has not really been around that long in the realm of human history. And when we think of major events, those stand out. And I think we have to engage with that because our audience is telling us as well something about what matters in history.
And it's always been that way. The first historians that we know of, you know, Herodotus, Thucydides, they were military historians.
And in this country too. If you think about the first histories being written, certainly in the 19th century, a lot of interest was cataloging the Revolutionary War and then the War of 1812. Those political and military events were very important early on, and in part because as soon as we had an American nation, that was the way people understood the nation, was the Revolution. We needed to understand the Revolution, what it meant, and the ideas that came out of it, or else you didn't understand what it meant to be an American.
Do you think that is why still today so much of American identity is tied up into that image of the nation as a military power?
It's an interesting question. I think for me, that's probably something that's changed over time, and that might be a byproduct of the 20th century. Because from my understanding, America really is a world global power. Is really a product of the 20th century and the wars of the 20th century. By the end of World War II, the United States is undoubtedly the global economic and military superpower. And so for most of us, we've simply gotten used to the idea of American hegemony, which is not something that's taken for granted in the 19th century. It's why during the Civil War, foreign policy is is both important and very uncertain. For a period of time, it looks possible that Britain and France might recognize the Confederacy. And so it's a very different world. So I think that's something we've learned to take for granted. But American history doesn't make that obvious. Not until we get to the 20th century.
And if I can cut in one second, there's noise in the background. I don't have a recording studio. We are sitting at my kitchen table, and I have two cats and a dog that are both wandering about and jingling. So that's what the background noise is about, and I apologize, but there's nothing that I can do about it at this point. So you're growing up in Minnesota, and you have this interest in the Civil War. You're reading the books that you got from your grandfather. And you go to University of Minnesota Twin Cities and you major in history and political science.
Yes.
Was your family happy with that decision? What was the line of thought behind choosing that major?
I can't necessarily remember whether or not they were necessarily happy with me choosing those majors. My brother had done some comp sci and then ended up doing business, and I knew I was never going to do those things. I liked math. I really liked astronomy and physics and thinking about the natural world. But I knew that science wasn't necessarily my skill set so much as I was interested in the ideas. So I knew I was interested in the world of ideas. So I needed to be in history or philosophy or something like that. I think my parents would not have accepted philosophy, because, you know, everyone thinks philosophers, what is it they do? They don't understand, you know, historians, it seems a little bit more obvious. And I think, you know, what helped is I did well enough, frankly. I did well enough in my time, in my studies, that they weren't worried because I ended up going to law school. I think there wasn't a problem because I ended up going to law school. But even there, I had legal history in mind. I entered into a program at University of Virginia that had been around since the 1970s that offered a JD and an MA in 3 years. So I went there knowing that I would do legal history and that I might end up being an academic. I don't know that everybody in my family necessarily wanted that. I didn't know right away that I wanted it. I think once I realized practicing law wasn't strictly for me, I knew that, again, I was interested in the world of ideas. And I think some of us come to that point where that is the thing that fascinates and drives us. And that's why I think people who are truly interested in history can speak and write about nearly anything, because it's not strictly just, you know, about American history or a particular set of events.
Was it always Civil War, or was there ever a possibility that you were going to switch focuses?
Well, growing up in undergrad, it certainly was. My undergrad thesis was about German immigrant soldiers, and I was very much interested in covering aspects of military history. But then when I went to law school and I did legal history, that took me to a very different world. So I had to think about politics and law in a very different set of characters. And I ended up writing about things outside of the Civil War as well. So I ended up, after law school, writing about the Supreme Court in the early 20th century. Look, I mean, some of those ideas come out of the Civil War and the Reconstruction period. That's part of its foundational history. I'm going all the way back to the founding period, because the way people in 1863 understood the Constitution and made constitutional arguments, maybe this won't surprise some people, is they look to the founding fathers. They look to the founding principles. Both sides of the argument believe that they properly understood the original intention of the Constitution. So that they had an intimate connection to that. So you had to understand the Revolution and the founding principles, and you had to understand American history to know that as well. So I think those experiences, both in law school and then in graduate school, just caused me to take a step back and to see the bigger picture. I think that's helpful when you re-engage with the Civil War too, because in some ways it also helps to inform you and tell you why, for instance, even particular battles matter so much, because you know just both how important and significant the Civil War itself is an event, but why in the context of those times these particular events also stand out.
Without making it a political question, what do you think of the people who today like to debate endlessly the intent of the framers of the Constitution? Do you think that that is still relevant today? Is it less relevant than it was in the 1860s?
I think it's still relevant today. I think they're often asking the right question. I think it comes down to a matter of interpretive principles. So what people are really arguing over ultimately is how do we figure out what that means? And that's what's really truly the hard question. And I think, frankly, that's where historians have to be part of the discussion. Is Jonathan Gnapp, who was once at the University of Mississippi, is now at Stanford. He recently came out with a book about the 1790s and the early debates over the meaning of the Constitution right after ratification. And, you know, one takeaway from that work is certainly the same thing, which is, look, they were arguing about what this meant right away. So how we understand how we approach that is a very complicated question. So maybe the biggest problem we have and that we have to tell people is understanding what the Constitution meant, what the framers were trying to do, what the people generally in the founding generation understood, is a complex question. And they can't simply be answered by referencing single framers from the Constitutional Convention. It's a difficult, robust process, and there isn't necessarily one answer to it. So it can be frustrating that way. It's not easy, and it's hard work. And frankly, the way that Americans used the framers during the 19th century shows that the same way, right? That they both agreed what the sources should be and where the values were, but they disagreed on what they meant. Their interpretations were different because they looked at different people. The way they used to look at it is some were Hamiltonians and some were Jeffersonians, right? That's sort of the kind of the 19th century lens. We don't really have that as much anymore. Some people would kind of say that's what originalism versus living constitutionalism. I don't think I understand it in a way, but in any case, I think people are asking the right questions about, you know, what we should continue to value. But it's hard to answer, and historians need to be part of that debate.
I agree. Very good point. So you went to the University of Virginia. Tell me, what is the appeal? What is the rationale? What possessed you to go into a concurrent MA JD program?
Well, my brother went to the University of Virginia Law School before me. And so I had a chance to go to Charlottesville and to visit campus before I even knew I wanted to go to law school. My final year in undergrad, I took a Supreme Court course, and we did a whole mock trial, and I was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and I wrote an opinion, and I wore a robe, and I really got engaged with this whole world. So that had me started thinking about it. So I took the LSAT, and I started applying, and I knew that University of Virginia was my number one target. And when I started looking to it, the joint degree program only made it more appealing to me, because I wasn't sure if I wanted to do law school or grad school. And this, for me, my ultimate target was, I don't have to make a choice. I can do both. And I wasn't sure if it would work out. Fortunately, it did.
So did you intend to practice law, or did you just want to get legal training because you're interested in legal history?
My intent was to pass a bar and to practice for a period of time and then maybe go back to academia later or something like that. I kind of thought maybe my long-term trajectory was a combination thereof. I wasn't really sure, but I knew I wanted to be at the school. Sometimes thinking as a 22-year-old isn't perfectly clear either, but
I'm almost 32 and my thinking still isn't perfectly clear.
So, you know, those were the factors going into it, but, you know, I don't know that I was certain about my long-term trajectory, and that was part of it, is I think I might want to be an academic. I'm not sure. I think I might want to be a lawyer. I'm not sure. If I do this, I hedge my bets, and I go to a really good school in a town that I really like. And that's what I, you know, I thought of, is it was a place where people had a great academic environment and experience, whereas most law schools not only didn't offer a joint degree, but also offered the promise of depression. Virginia gave me really kind of the right, you know, combination of elements. And it still even took me a couple years after law school to fully accept that I have academia is what I need to do. You know, I need to have a PhD. I need to be in the world of ideas, and I need to be writing about these things, because what I liked was the idea behind laws, the principles behind laws, the history behind them, the Constitution itself. But lawyers don't regularly necessarily deal with it. There are a handful of lawyers who do constitutional law regularly, and they're very special. So that wasn't going to be something I could just do. so I needed to have experience, too, to confirm things later. Mm. I think that's usually what happens to people as well.
So at the University of Virginia, you worked with one of my favorite historians, Gary Gallagher.
Yes. I had the fortune to do so, and that was after I had read many of his books. So as the weirdest experience, in the sense that it was the first time I'd ever gone into a classroom and been starstruck. Never had a professor and thought, oh my God, I read their books. I'm so nervous. I can't make a comment in class. But Gary Gallagher, I didn't know what to expect. And Gary Gallagher was, I think I just had the total fortune of being able to experience being in several of his classes and getting his mentorship and really getting a finer idea of both an approach to history and a method to doing history, and to really understanding the full scope of the Civil War. So I think I went in thinking, you know, Gary does a great job of covering military history in an academic way. And then what I learned is that he does so much more than that. And a great work of history, especially in the Civil War, can kind of show you everything. It can give you an idea, especially when you're dealing military events, of how political events, social events are all tied into this. And it helps you to get a full picture of their world at the time. And I don't think I would have ever thought of history nearly that way if I didn't have that fortune. So I tend to think that was one of those things where the stars aligned and I just somehow lucked into you know, being able to take classes with him. And it's the best thing that happened to me at the University of Virginia, outside of meeting my wife,
right,
which is the most obvious good thing that happened to me. So all the debt from law school was worth those two things.
So Lindsay, if you listen to this.
I had to backtrack there. Sorry, I almost said Gary Gallagher over my wife.
I don't know him other than through his work, but by reputation, but he's really what I aspire to be, in that he is so good that he can get away with being curmudgeonly.
And I think that, again, what Gary does so well is to take the lessons of good academic historians and just show, to grapple with military history using those tools and to show exactly why it matters. And that's important right now because we're in a time in which, you know, there seems to be a growing lot of people who question the value of military history. And, you know, there's sort of that sense that there's only so much space for, you know, different types of Civil War history as opposed to value social history and military history.
There's not, y'all. People love Civil War books. We can all just keep writing about whatever we want and it'll be fine.
I can attest to this because my own work in the Civil War deals with an area that fewer people have somehow written about, because there are so many Civil War books, but somehow there are still areas that can be written about. And I think you know that as well.
Right. And I want to get to that. So you take your JD, MA, you work, I know you worked at the Cato Institute. Then, so this gets to the point that you and I met. You entered the doctoral program at the University of Mississippi.
Yes.
What was the what was that decision process like?
You know, I only applied to probably a handful of programs, mostly at Southern universities, because I knew I needed to go to a place, frankly, where they're going to support a project on the Civil War.
Right.
And I, you know, talked to Dr. Gallagher about that, tried to get advice on what programs to look at. So I was pretty much looking at Southern institutions. And, you know, I visited Oxford, and it seemed like a small, quaint Southern college town, which it turned out to indeed be. And I had lived in a place like that before, so I was willing to do that again. And they gave a lot of support to their graduate students, which is always an important thing to see, is that you need to go to programs where they will support you and they're interested in your project. You need those things. So I got the sense that that would be available to me there. And so that's what ended up taking me there. And even a little bit of an adventurous spirit. I was willing to try. I wanted to live somewhere else. So, you know, Minnesota to Virginia to D.C. to Mississippi. And yes, people in Minnesota said, why are you going to Mississippi?
Yes. And I want to say, and I don't want to talk too much about the University of Mississippi, but I will always be very appreciative that because of their strong emphasis on the Civil War that, you know, they were willing to fund me to get a master's degree, which allowed me to be in the doctoral program that I am today. They really do great work supporting Civil War scholarship there. What is it? Is it the University of Mississippi Center for Civil War Research?
It's the Center for Civil War Research. And I've been a beneficiary of that because they, once you're in the PhD, once you're in that phase, every year they give out a fellowship, and that fellowship allows you to simply do research that year. So you get the full stipend, the full support, and all you have to do is do research. So that allowed me to go to archives, that allowed me to travel to Pennsylvania. Things like that are really good when they have that specifically for Civil War research. And so I knew that, and that's helpful. You mean, you need things like that to get through a PhD program because it is going to take you a matter of years. And so knowing that support is available for your specific projects, because most people enter a PhD program knowing what they're going to write about. I think that that was an important part of the equation. And they certainly do that there. So it's a feather in their cap.
So tell us about your dissertation project.
So when I did my master's thesis, I just covered a case in Pennsylvania at the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in 1863 that found conscription unconstitutional. So my mentor in the law school, so not Gary Gallagher, but Charles McCurdy, found an article about it. He shared it with me, and I thought, that's fascinating. I didn't think any court had ever thought the draft or conscription was unconstitutional. So I need to know more about that. So I just, when I did my master's thesis, I just looked into Pennsylvania. I kind of looked at some other stuff, but I really just focused on Pennsylvania because it's a master's thesis. So, you know, you're limited in what you're covering. So when I wanted to do a dissertation, I wanted to blow it up. And what I really wanted to do was to show that in the 19th century, Americans took constitutional arguments seriously. When I say that, what I mean is they weren't merely just about politics. They really valued the Constitution itself and upholding what they believed was the, you know, the founders' intentions. This mattered a great deal to them. So they expected their politicians to do the same. So part of my project was to look at the congressional debates over the Conscription Act, but also newspaper debates, pamphlet debates, and then, of course, court cases, to try to figure out if there are any other instances in which courts cited against the draft and what arguments specifically lawyers were making. So I wanted to recover the constitutional arguments themselves because most historians who had ever covered the subject had done very little to actually show the reader what was being argued because they were being dismissed. These were just angry Democrats. They were willing to use whatever arguments they needed to. It doesn't really matter, right? It's window dressing to their real intention, which is to just be a thorn in the side of the Lincoln administration. I'm going to show that, yes, they are a thorn in the side of the Lincoln administration, but the vehicle that they choose to use to resist the acts of the administration that they believed unconstitutional matters. And what they're using is constitutional arguments. That's what they go to. There are a variety of tools one can use to try to resist acts of the government, and their choice was to do it this way, and specifically to hope to reach the Supreme Court to overturn the act. So I wanted to recover that discourse and those arguments themselves, and to really show that, at least for a period of time, it looked possible that the Lincoln administration could lose the argument of the courts.
Now, I just thought of this, so it may go horribly and throw you off, but take, say, the greatest hits of the historiography that you're engaging in. You know, if there are the two or three works that you want to place your dissertation in conversation with.
Yeah, so the most obvious, the biggest name is Mark Neely. And Mark Neely had written a journal article about it in 1996. And then he's written several books covering the constitutional history of the Civil War, including about the Pennsylvania case that I covered. He hadn't recovered some of the original documents that I looked at, the arguments, the oral arguments, and the original complaint that was filed. He hadn't looked at any of that, but he was familiar with the case, and he had been pretty dismissive of the seriousness of these arguments against the draft. I think he didn't actually buy it. In other words, I think in Neely's mind, he didn't think that there was a good argument that the draft was in fact unconstitutional or possibly unconstitutional. I think the question is closer, and I'm not necessarily advocating that it is unconstitutional, just that I recognize and I think that there's a real argument to be made there. So Neely's the first one because he's written the most and he's covered it. And then beyond that, you have to go further back. So James Randall wrote in 1926, so after World War I. He matters because Randall covers everything, and he's writing after the Supreme Court unanimously upholds conscription during World War I. He's a major figure. And then Carl Brent Swisher wrote the Oxford History of the Taney period, and he also covers a lot of the events that I go over. So I engage with some of those older works. And then the other group is there's a recent set of legal historians who include Cynthia Nicoletti and Peter Hofferin. And what they're doing is trying to recover the role of lawyers. And in the sense that most of the politicians in power during the Civil War were by occupation lawyers. So the gentlemen who are making the arguments in Congress are trained lawyers. So in some ways, it helps us support the idea that, you know, these folks had thought about this seriously, right? They are trained to do so. So that was the tool in their shed, so to speak, to use. So that's important context as well, sort of resurrecting the role of legal actors and lawyers principally during the Civil War.
Did any of these cases reach the Supreme Court during the Civil War era?
They did not. So only one question out of the Conscription Act of 1863 ever reached the Supreme Court, and that was in 1865. And it had nothing to do with the constitutionality of the act. It was merely about the meaning of the word enrollment under the act. So it was not about the core constitutional question. The Supreme Court doesn't actually say anything about it till 1872 in a case called Tarbell's case, and it's in dicta. So in other words, it's not part of the core ruling. It doesn't necessarily have a precedential effect. But Justice Field in that case suggests that conscription is constitutional. But it will not reach the Supreme Court until 1918. And part of the reason it doesn't is that President Lincoln and his cabinet don't seem very interested in having it get there, because I don't believe they think they necessarily were confident they would have won. So in March 1863, the same month that the Conscription Act passes Congress, Supreme Court decides the prize cases. And in a 5-4 decision, they narrowly uphold Lincoln's power, his claimed power to blockade the southern ports in April 1861 under his powers as commander-in-chief. That case is narrow, right? That case is close. So one signal that might come out of there is it's not obvious if this case gets to the Supreme Court. that they're going to rule in favor of the Lincoln administration. What Lincoln also doesn't know is that Taney has already written an opinion privately. So we know from his leftover correspondence that sometime after the act passed, he wrote an opinion finding the Conscription Act unconstitutional. He also wrote an opinion for the Legal Tender Act and the Emancipation Proclamation. But in any case, he was ready to strike it down. He never got an opportunity. He'll die in November 1864. But Lincoln at least had some signals that he couldn't necessarily trust the Supreme Court. Of course, the other obvious signal is most of the members, there are several members on the Supreme Court still who had decided Dred Scott. So Lincoln's had an opportunity to put some justices on the Supreme Court. McLean dies in 1861, I believe. He puts Clifford on the court. I'm trying to remember when he puts Field on the court. And of course, Taney will be replaced by Treasury Secretary
Salmon Chase. Yes,
Salmon Chase. So Chase is in the cabinet.
Yeah.
And so Chase is part of the discussions about what to do about these courts who are acting on cases dealing with conscripts.
And Chase is also a radical Republican.
Yes. And Chase, separate issue. Chase believes that state courts have the power to decide these cases. And that's one of the things that the Lincoln administration is arguing, that state courts can't do this. Part of the reason they're probably making that argument is they don't trust state court judges be on their side necessarily, and as my research will show, that they weren't entirely wrong about that. But they, I think what they really wanted to do was limit the amount of opportunities opponents of conscription had to challenge it. They wanted to limit the chance that it might actually get to the Supreme Court. And so even in the case that I study out of Pennsylvania, the Lincoln administration initially refuses to send government counsel. So in the first oral argument, they don't even send their representatives. So there's a story in the middle of court where the justices of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, they stand up, start proceedings. They say, well, where's the government? They have to send someone out to the hotel. They have to come back and say, look, apparently they skipped town. And Democratic papers suggested that they got orders from the Lincoln administration telling them to do so. But we have no such proof.
And there are state court hearings in Pennsylvania?
Yes. They'll eventually strike down the act in November 1863. And so when they hold oral argument in September, government doesn't even show up. But they show up in December. By that point, the Chief Justice of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, who found conscription unconstitutional, has been replaced by a Republican because he narrowly lost his judicial election. And so as soon as he's off the court, government counsel shows up, goes to one of the Republican members of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court and petitions to have a hearing to reverse the injunctions that were issued in November. And they successfully do that. So they're playing a different game. In some ways, you might see that they're sort of moving the signposts in order to ensure that they don't end up getting to the court. And the other thing I mentioned is that in August, Lincoln himself writes a letter. He drafts a short opinion about the constitutionality of conscription.
August 1863.
And he doesn't publicly share that, but that's in his papers. So he has that on hand too, just like Taney does. So he's sort of ready in case it happens. And he's thinking about that because he's corresponding with New York Governor Horatio Seymour about the constitutionality of the Conscription Act. Because after the New York draft riots, Seymour writes in and says, look, you should suspend the draft. Draft's unconstitutional anyways. And we should get it before the court and have this decided for everybody. It will be better for the people if this is decided. Because if it is constitutional, then we'll have more respect for the act. We won't have any of these other riots. But Lincoln's response is, look, privately, he's saying it's constitutional, clearly has the power under Article 1, Section 8. But he's telling Seymour, look, if the court case comes up, I respect that. But I'm not going to stop this draft because we need the men in the field right now. In the contest of 1863, this is right after Gettysburg. So in Lincoln's mind, the stakes are still very, very high.
And so we said earlier that these are mostly state court cases. Do they get into the federal court system?
They do. So my principal case is a state Supreme Court case out of Pennsylvania. And I have several cases from the New York courts. And those are pretty much all state court cases. New York is set up differently. The New York State Supreme Court is actually not the highest court. So actually, those cases are trial courts, and the appellate court is the highest court. In New York, there's only one case finding the act unconstitutional, and that's actually at the city level. So a city judge in New York City during the draft riots finds conscription unconstitutional. It's just the New York Supreme Court, so the next level up, by the next month, says he never had the power to issue that opinion, and that sort of ends that controversy. And then all their challenges, New York, get dismissed for jurisdictional reasons. So they never get to the core question there. In Pennsylvania, it does actually come before the federal court twice. So Judge John Cadwalader's brother, General Cadwalader, is actually the commander in Maryland who arrests Merriman. So many people know the case Ex Parte Merriman from 1861. So it's the same Cadwalader. And he gets two cracks at the apple, one in March and one in September. In March, his decision stems partly from the Militia Act of 1862, but then also the Conscription Act that's just been passed. He upholds the power of conscription. And then in September, he does so again in another lengthy opinion. But he also suggests that federal court justices, at least, have a role in reviewing the decisions of boards of enrollment. So boards of enrollment are basically the boards that decide the specifics of a draft in each individual. So under the Act, the country is basically divided up into districts. So you have a board in each district, and then you have a provost marshal. So you have enforcement of the draft, right? And the board is going to decide on which conscripts get exemptions from the Act. Cadwalader is keeping a role for federal courts to at least review the decisions of the boards. And the Lincoln administration is not happy with Cadwalader. So this September cabinet meeting, they're complaining specifically about him. And another federal district court judge, I'm blanking right now on the other name, but the also because they had released a lot of soldiers under what's called writs of habeas corpus. So writ of habeas corpus just means to present the body. So it essentially means it's a legal term for tell us why this person's been arrested.
Yeah, that's that little piece of the Constitution that stops the government from just throwing people in jail for no reason.
That's correct. And so in the military context, it's prove why this person is being confined in military prison or under military law. And so if you're ever going to challenge the Conscription Act, the most logical way to do so is by writ of habeas corpus, because you're an individual draftee, which by military law means you're already under military law. So you have to do it this way. And Pennsylvania, they try to get around that because the writ's already been suspended. Their way of getting around that is to use what's called equity court. So they ask for a temporary injunction against the Board of Enrollment, the enrollment officers and the Board of Enrollment, to have these individual soldiers released because the underlying act is unconstitutional. So it's kind of a clever strategy that they have to use. But they're saying that the only reason that they have to do this is because Lincoln suspended habeas. And why did Lincoln suspend habeas? Because he was sick of these soldiers getting released, specifically more often by federal judges. Although when I looked at the numbers, I think it's 40 soldiers by state judges, 30 or 40, and even more by these federal judges. That count comes from me just looking in both the state and federal archives, just at the sheer amount of approved writs of habeas corpus that you can find in the records. I wouldn't be surprised if there's more, because record keeping in the 19th century is notoriously lacking. So, you know, there's a good chance that there's even more than are accounted for. And that was much to Lincoln's frustration. So that's why he suspended the writ again in September 1863. And, you know, that's why seemingly they instructed the government attorneys to ignore the Pennsylvania Supreme Court.
Well, as we get ready to conclude our siege of Petersburg here, do you have any sort of closing thoughts, summary thoughts on conscription and resistance in the North?
Yes, I think the most important takeaway here is that, you know, not only am I trying to resurrect this this rhetoric and this intense debate, but it's also to, in the broader picture, to resurrect this tradition of resisting conscription throughout American history. Because in 1863, you know, what these Democrats, or as I refer to them as constitutional conservatives, I do that first off to get past party labels and just sheer partisanship. And second, to point to the tradition that they're using. The tradition they're invoking is, hey, we believe in voluntary armies. We believe in the citizen soldier. We didn't draft in the War of 1812. We didn't draft in the Mexican-American War. And we didn't have a federal draft in the Revolutionary War. That's key because, of course, some states actually had drafts during the Revolutionary War. One of the key arguments here is what matters is who drafts, not that they draft. So the states can use a draft to put together their militias, but the federal government can't come and take individual citizens and force them into a regular federal army. That's what they're getting after. So they're not, this isn't an individual rights argument necessarily the way it might come out in the 21st century. So the tradition they're pointing to is a little bit different than what we think of. But that keeps going. So World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam War, we see similar contests against the conscriptions that are passed during those wars. And they're unsuccessful, even more unsuccessful. My argument is that during the Civil War, this was close. So close battle. You know, we have a state court that actually overturned it, only briefly, but they did. We don't have that in World War I. We don't have that in World War II. We don't have that in Vietnam. World War I, all the courts are very robustly defend the right of the federal government to freely conscript. And in Vietnam, the ACLU under Attorney Leon Freeman wrote a nearly 200-page brief going through all the constitutional history, all this tradition of constitutional resistance to the draft going back to the founding period. And the Supreme Court, you know, wrote one page. So, look, we already decided this issue. We're not resisting it. And that's it. So you could put together all this tradition, which is still alive in the world of ideas, but the Supreme Court hasn't been open to it in the 20th century. And the last piece would be that, but at the same time, we still have the Selective Services Act. We still live in a world where we have to register for the draft, where Congress is talking about expanding that to include women, where that's actually something that's courts are dealing with at the moment. So it's a live issue with this real constitutional tradition behind it. And so I'm hoping to at least educate people a little bit about where that is and where I think the sort of the height of that tradition is, right? Where the questions and the best arguments are really presented in 1863 in this particular small pocket of time.
I think I may have aged past where it would matter anyway, but I still have my Selective Service card. It's in my lockbox with my passport.
You have to do it at 18 to what? Like 25, something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so at some point it stops mattering. I mean, I guess you know that you're old in this country once you know, the draft gets called out again, you're not in the first round.
For people who know me, know that if I'm getting called in the first round of the draft, we're in very dire straits. You did a really great summary there, but I'm going to ruin it by asking another question because something you said got me interested.
Sure.
So the argument is being who has the right to draft.
Yes.
So I have read the Constitution all the way through, but it's been a while.
Sure.
The wording of the Second Amendment says, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state.
Yes.
Is it just that word militia that would lead a constitutional conservative to interpret as the states have the right to raise troops?
Honestly, it's a whole phrase that's used, because the Second Amendment does come up in some of these cases, and certainly comes up in both the newspapers and the pamphlets and the arguments of Congress. So the Second Amendment, it's not one of the core arguments. I think of it as kind of a secondary argument, because the way constitutional conservatives are using it in 1863 is to say, look, I mean, the Second Amendment too confirms this tradition, because it's talking about a well-regulated militia necessary to securing a free state. So we're talking about confirming that states still have these reserved rights, and one of those is that they get to regulate and control their own militias. So that means that they can draft their citizens should they need to in order to fill the militia, who can then be called out under Article 1, Section 8 if there's a national emergency. So the Constitution lists three emergencies. Of course, one of them is insurrection. So yes, you have a civil war, you can call out the militia. They weren't saying that they couldn't call it the militia. What they're saying is they couldn't ignore the militia and directly just draft individual citizens into the National Army, which is what the Conscription Act was aiming to do. Because the argument of Senator Henry Wilson, who created the Conscription Act, was, well, look, this doesn't destroy the militia. It has nothing to do with the militia, because we don't even deal with them. We just deal with the individual citizens. And constitutional conservatives are saying, yes, that's precisely the problem. So they're sort of talking past each other in that sense.
So they had quotas for recruitment per state, right?
They did up until that point. So under
Yeah.
So under the Militia Act of 1862, basically that had been a harder version of all the previous militia acts. Because what they said is, look, states, you still have control. We're going to give you quotas. But if you don't meet your quota, we can force you to run a draft, and we can make sure we have control to say up to what point you have to bring out more men, basically. In other words, if the states didn't produce enough men, then the federal government could intervene, and specifically the president could intervene.
Okay.
So the Militia Act of 1862 was trying to kind of balance between the growing manpower necessities of the war in respecting this older tradition of we set quotas, the states do what they need to do to fill them, and that's it. Because that was the old system, right? We have a volunteer regular army, then we have the militia, the states control that, we call them out if we need them under a certain set of emergencies, that's it. The Conscription Act says that didn't work. We're just going to directly call up citizens, and we're going to offer bounties, and hopefully that will get a lot more people to volunteer. And in some sense that, arguably that worked to some extent. There are more volunteers than there are conscripts. But part of that, too, is at least in my research, it's because a lot of towns reacted to the Conscription Act by passing taxes specifically to pay for bounties so that not a lot of their citizens get drafted. Saying, like, look, we're going to raise money. We're going to go pay for other people to go to war. And there are actually a lot of court cases about whether or not states or localities can actually properly do that. It's a real big change. I think the point there is that it actually is a big change. And so the Conscription Act is new. The extent to which it isn't new is that James Monroe, as Secretary of War in 1814, tried to pass a national conscription. It didn't pass because the war ended. So Andrew Jackson supported it. Monroe got pushed by him and others to put this idea through in late 1814. But there was resistance in Congress, and enough, at least, to table it during the recess over January, right? So between December and January, there was a recess. They got it tabled enough to make sure that they didn't have a final vote, basically. And in that time, the war ended. And so it wasn't an issue anymore. So it's actually, during the Civil War, both sides are debating whether or not that act was actually going to pass, whether or not it was actually precedent. So it had been tried, but it had never actually been done. And during the War of 1812, part of the reason is that several New England state governors refused the call out, because they say, we're not going to let militia troops be used to invade Canada. They can't be used for foreign invasions, basically, or offensive warfare.
Right.
And so there's some interesting history there, right? But that, so that's the tradition they're pointing to, and the Conscription Act really is a change. But it is important to understand that they're not saying that conscription can never happen. They're saying that the national government cannot conscript.
Well, now that we've reached this point, I really just want to go through the next 100 years of U.S. conscription history, but maybe we should save that for next time we get together.
Yes.
Before we take it home here, do you want to plug social media, anything?
Well, I don't have any recent writings now because I'm about to defend my dissertation, so hopefully there will be more to come socially shortly after that. I can be found on Twitter. I think my handle is nmosvik.
nmosvik. November, November, Moscow, Oscar, Sierra.
There you go.
V-I-C-K.
And I don't always talk about history, so I can't promise anybody anything. But I hope after the dissertation to publish a variety of things, because I have a lot of research that I didn't even end up using. As I mentioned, there's a whole subcategory of other cases that get taken up that are related to conscription, but not necessarily about it. So there's a lot that comes out of the fact that it's just a completely new problem in terms of what the courts have dealt with, right? No court before this period of time had ever taken up the question, not directly. So it's important to realize that when we say it's novel, it's novel. Other than that, I think the only plug is to hopefully say that I successfully defended my dissertation in the coming days.
Absolutely, and I was going to say, but you scooped me. Yeah. So as we're recording this, it's Friday. Nick is going to defend his dissertation on Monday. So we certainly wish him the best and have all of the confidence in the world. Well, man, if this podcast goes more than one episode, I definitely want to have you back on, because I feel like we've just scratched the surface of a really fascinating topic.
I would love to come back.
Thank you so much for doing this with me.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you guys so much for listening to the podcast if you made it this far. I want to provide a small but important update. Nick did, in fact, successfully defend his dissertation last Monday. So I want to offer a very heartfelt congratulations to my friend and a friend of the podcast, Dr. Nicholas Mosvik. Nick, thank you so much for agreeing to be my guinea pig for this show. You have an open invitation to come back anytime you like. Please follow Dr. Mosvik on Twitter at NMOsvik. Thanks to our producer, Chris Rowley, for taking my mess and turning it into something you all could listen to. Follow Chris on Twitter at Chris Rowley. That is Chris with a K. And Chris, I have never actually heard your last name spoken, so I apologize if I got it wrong. Thank you to my buddy Hector Moreno for creating this fantastic Outlaw History Podcast graphic. You can follow him on Twitter at Hectzilla. And please visit hect.rocks to find links to where you can purchase other great designs Hector has created. Finally, thank you for listening. Please follow me on Twitter at Outlaw Historian for news on the podcast going forward. I don't know what we're doing for hosting yet, but I hope to have subscription information for you very soon. Once more, I have been Trey, the Outlaw Historian. From me and from all of us here at the Outlaw History Podcast, we'll see y'all later.